Why don't we go ahead and do the Pledge of Allegiance and get started here. So the first item is the pledge. We don't need to stand for it. We can sit for it. So if you'll join me, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation,
for which it stands,
indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. All right. So we have established that we have a quorum with Bill Rice, Laurie Miller, and Iggy Fedorov. Did I get the pronunciation right for Ron's
name? Yeah, Laurie and Cecilia are here too. Cecilia Montalvo is here.
Ah, she must be on my next page. Yep. Hi, Cecilia.
Hey, how are
and
you?
Kathy Tanner is connecting to audio. Welcome, yep. Kathy. All right. So right now, if any members of the public would like to comment for items not on the agenda, you can have 3 minutes. Hearing none, we will move to the consent agenda with approval of the minutes of the February 16, 2021 regular board meeting.
Move to accept.
Second.
Okay. Simone, you want to take a roll call on that?
Yes. Iggy Fedorov?
Yes.
Bill Rice?
Yes.
Laurie Miller?
She said yes.
Oh, she's you're muted, Laurie.
Okay. Cecilia Montalvo.
Laurie yes. Nods.
All right.
Four it was a nod, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, we had a request a few minutes ago to move Mike Grove's presentation up to the next item on the agenda so as not to hold him up. Somebody want to make that motion and second it?
A motion is not necessary unless there's objection.
All right. Anyone object? Good. No objection. So go ahead, Mike, with your annual report.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mike Groves. For those of you who don't know me, I've been at the EMSA for about 2 years now as an EMS coordinator, but I have 42 years in EMS business and 41 of those as a paramedic. Started my career at Los Angeles City Fire Department, spent 21 years there as a paramedic. I have worked at San Luis Ambulance and have been in all. Can you guys hear me okay?
So Mike McDonough, would you mute if you're going to carry on a conversation? Thanks. All right, go ahead, Mike.
That's okay. All right, so anyway, I have a little bit of experience on this. So I wanted to start off, first of all, answering a concern that you guys had just brought up that nobody from the EMSA had been here for a few years to do any kind of an update. And there's actually a very good reason for that. And it's the same reason as everything else right now, and that's COVID. And as a result, I'd like to go over, spend a few minutes talking about what we've been doing at the EMSA, what our challenges have been, and what we're looking forward to do in the next year that will include the healthcare district as well. And then I have some basic QI statistics to go over with you guys, and we'll put a little PowerPoint up there when we're ready for that. So first of all, the EMSA update. Last year was extremely challenging. I mentioned I've been in this business 42 years, and I have never seen in my entire career anything like this last year. From the point of view of the EMSA, we have been pretty much neck deep in the COVID response, starting almost exactly a year ago when the county opened up the Emergency Operations Center. At that time, every one of our staff were moved full-time to the EOC, including me. I was there for about 2 months working as the EMS group supervisor, a position I still hold, so I'm kind of doing two jobs. But after a little while, they allowed me to move back into the office so that we could try to get some of our regular EMS functions completed. the entirety of our staff has been pretty much full-time at the EOC since then. Just in the last couple of weeks, we've gotten another of our coordinators back half-time, but he's still working primarily in logistics, working in the vaccine part. Vince Perucci, who's our director at the EMS agency, is the full-time operations chief, probably working 60 hours a week down there. So he doesn't have a whole lot of time for EMSA functions. Our other coordinator has been pulled in full-time to work in the surveillance section over there. And so she's full-time there and hasn't been able to do much with us either. That being said, there are a lot of things that we just haven't been able to do. As a result of that, we've been able to waive a number of, some of these were from the state, we were able to waive a number of requirements for certifications, which we are continuing to do that in a paramedic accreditations. Probably our number one priority right now. But we've been able to waive some of the requirements. We've also been able to get a waiver for some of the state requirements. For example, our, you know, measuring our ambulance performance or ambulance patient offload times and our yearly EMS report that we're supposed to submit to the state. They've allowed all the LEMSAs or the local EMS agencies to defer that until later in the year. And we're hoping we can get caught up. On a local point of view, we were attempting last year to, we changed from what we called advanced protocol review, which was a every two-year class that we required paramedics to go through to maintain their accreditation. And we were moving to a yearly update class that was going to be put on by the EMSA, but at, you know, different locations. And we were scheduled to do that in the month of May last year. And of course that got canceled. We're trying to do it again this year. We suspect it's going to be later summer or possibly fall before we can actually do that. Along with that were some protocol changes that we had planned for last year that we've also been unable to do. We also plan on trying to implement that later in the year as well. So you can see that our challenges have been pretty significant. Now, some of the things that we have been able to accomplish, though, pretty much COVID-related, were, for example, and this was one of my jobs as the EMS group supervisor, was to write several local optional scope of practice requests to the state to allow EMTs and paramedics to go beyond their normal scope of practice. For example, wrote the, we call them an LSOP, for COVID testing nasal swabs for EMTs and paramedics to be able to do. We wrote an LSOP to allow paramedics to administer vaccines both for influenza and COVID vaccine. And most recently, we were also able to write an LSOP to allow EMTs to train to administer vaccines. Now that's very, very different. EMTs, by their general scope of practice, have never been allowed to administer medications via IM, intramuscular shots, and we're doing that now. And as a result of that, we're also working on another LSOP to allow, and it may affect you guys a little bit in the CAL FIRE units that you have there, to allow EMTs to administer epinephrine for anaphylaxis and severe allergic reaction intramuscularly instead of by auto-injector. And that's really a cost savings issue. The cost of using draw up epi versus an auto-injector is about, I don't know, it's maybe at best a quarter of the cost of an auto-injector. So that becomes pretty costly. So we're working on those kind of things right now. We're also, we had tried to move the skills testing for both EMTs and paramedics to the local agencies. And we've actually started doing that as of the first of the year. So all of the local agencies now will be doing their, what we refer to as low use, high risk skills that we require testing at least once a year. And in some cases, twice a year. And in some cases, four times a year when it comes to airways, for example. And we're moving that to the individual agencies using skills forms and testing that we came up with. And so we're starting to do that. We're having the field training officers at each agency do it. And to that end, just a little quick shout out to Tim Bennis, who we have appointed as a field training officer. He's one of the first in Cambria, the healthcare district. And he's been doing a pretty good job at that. So he'll be the one who's running that training in there as well. And so that's kind of our you know, hopes and dreams here. Of course, what happens with COVID is going to be the determining factor on all of this. It looking right now like things might start to, you know, loosen up a little bit, but there have been some disturbing trends that we're noticing. The calls, while they have been, the number of cases, while they have been coming down, have plateaued, and they plateaued at a rate that was probably similar to what the second wave was back in the spring. And that's where we're plateauing now. And we just don't know if those are going to go back up. On a good point, however, it looks like we're getting more and more vaccines available coming into the county, and we're ramping up the ability that, to administer the vaccines. Heaven knows we have enough people available that we can draw on to administer those vaccines, both through the county sites and then through some of the pharmacies and some other sites. Hospitals are doing some of the vaccines. So we're really ramping it up in the county. It depends 100% on when we get the vaccines as to how quickly we can administer those. But that's looking promising now as well. So that's kind of the ENSA update.
I have a question.
Sure.
Have you considered mobile vaccination, just, you know, mobile sites to distribute the vaccine? In other words, vaccine in a van?
Yeah, that's really not feasible because of the temperature requirements for most of the vaccines. Potentially for the J&J, that's something that might occur later on. And I'm sure that the people at the vaccine unit are discussing those as options. But right now, what we're trying to do is just set up as many sites. You know, we have the three sites through the county, one in Paso, one at Cuesta College, and one in the South County. There is a potential that, you know, there could be, for example, points of distribution sites set up at other local areas later as more vaccine becomes available. But I don't really have an answer for you on that.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions before we move on? Okay. Mike, if you want to throw that PowerPoint up, I can show you some of the numbers that we have for... Okay, you can go to the first slide here. So I didn't have a whole lot of time to do this, and I apologize for not doing it at quite the level that that Douglas had done in the past, but then again, it's just me over there, you know, right now trying to get as much stuff done as I can. So what I thought I would kind of take a look at was the differences between 2019 and 2020, because that's really what the issue is here. So we started off with the total number of responses. And by the way, all of the data that I've acquired here has been through the healthcare district image trend report writer system. It's actually a pretty powerful tool. And as I get into it more and learn more about it, there's an awful lot of information we can get out of that. So we started off with basically the total 911 responses. And these are 911 code 3, code 3 and code 2 responses, but it's the total number of emergency responses by the healthcare district ambulances in 2019 and 2020. You can see that there is a decrease in the calls on both the number of calls and the number of transports. If you go to the next slide, the difference in the calls, 11.5% decrease in just the total number of calls, but a 15.2% decrease in the total number of transports. That's fairly significant. I haven't had a chance to go through and look, and I'm sure that Mike has that ability. He gets into the same image trend system as I do to be able to watch and track what's going on this year. What I can tell you is that looking at ambulance data throughout 2020, I've noticed there was a huge drop everywhere about a year ago, starting in March and into April. And then it has steadily climbed since to the point to where January and February of this year, it looks like call load is kind of back to normal, and in some cases even a little bit higher than it had been in some previous years. So it looks like those calls are coming back up, but it's taken quite a while to get there. Most of that decrease in call load occurred during the months of March, April, May, June of last year before things started to climb back up. I don't know exactly what the numbers were, but I suspect it was probably about a, and I know at least looking at San Luis Ambulance data as well, their call load had dropped approximately 25% during the month of April, and a corresponding drop of 25% in their transports for April. That has since climbed back up, and where their numbers are a little bit better than yours, but then again, their numbers are way bigger than yours too. So, it's, you know, the difference is understandable. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so we wanted to look at this real quickly. It represents the median response time and then the 90th percentile response time. The 90th percentile response time is that time at which 90% of calls arrive on scene in your area. Now, this is complicated, so I'll try to go over it as much as I can here. First of all, what I measured here were 911 code 3 calls only. If you add non-emergency calls to that, that's going to skew your time and make everything much longer, and that's inappropriate to do. So these are emergency calls only. I find it interesting that the median time of 6.72 and then a slight drop this year of 6.4 minutes is actually pretty good when you consider that in your area, area one in the ambulance response zones, is pretty spread out. That's why the 90th percentile time is as high as it is. That includes all those calls to places like San Simeon, out Highway 46, any of those areas that are outside Cambria proper. If I had more time, I could break that down, and you would probably see that the times within Cambria, within the urban area in Cambria, are probably less than the 10-minute, which is kind of the gold standard that most places go off of. So while those times at 12.32 and this year, the 13.46 minutes, look a little high for a 90th percentile, it's really not that bad when you consider that these are for your entire area and include those areas where there's where it's much longer response times. So your units are getting there pretty well, pretty quickly, as evidenced by your median times that are, you know, 6.5 minutes or so. That's pretty good. Next slide. Okay, so we wanted to look at, these are kind of the important things from the EMSA point of view. A lot of the other QI stuff, Mike can get that for you. You know, if you're looking at things like the number of IVs attempted, intubations, although I can give you the intubations, I will in a minute here. But some of those, you know, agency-specific QI components should be done by the individual agencies. We're looking at what the EMSA is looking at. In this particular case, we're looking at calls that go to or meet some kind of a specialty care center response. And that includes STEMI calls, trauma consult or trauma alert calls, and cardiac arrests. So we'll start with STEMI. Those numbers are really low. Not a lot of STEMIs coming out of Cambria. And it's interesting that there was only one in all of 2020. I'll have to dig deeper into that to find out. That seems a little low to me. But I chair the STEMI committee, and I can tell you that in looking at all those calls, I don't recall seeing that many from Cambria. There were three in 2020, and STEMI for, just as a reminder, is ST elevation MI. It's a specific type of heart attack that needs to go to a specialty care center so that they can get them into the cardiac cath lab quickly. The gold standard there is under 90 minutes. It's a little tough to meet the 90 minutes out of Cambria just because of the transport times, but they do, you know, pretty well. So the what we call door to balloon time, which is the time, in our case, the time that the unit arrives on scene and recognizes a STEMI until they get into the cath lab, the standard there you like to see is 90 minutes. I didn't have a lot of time to pull up the specific data, but I think you guys have been pretty close on recognized STEMIs to getting in that 90 minutes. In your cases, it's kind of similar to STEMI calls coming out of the North County, out of Paso or north of Paso, which will bypass two hospitals to get down to the STEMI center or trench hospital. They're also very close to the 90 minutes. But generally speaking, we meet that pretty well in this county. trauma calls. So you'll see that they were very similar between the 2 years. We had 31 in 2019, 30 in 2020. And those calls represent not all trauma calls. Those represent trauma calls which were called in as either a step four consultation, step three consultation, step two or step one trauma alerts. So those are the ones where they meet specific criteria to go to a trauma center. And then they have the four categories, with step four being the least severe and step one being the most severe. You can see that there was really no change. Now, it's interesting because there was obviously a significant decrease in call load and a significant decrease in the number of transports, but the critical calls, the critical trauma calls, stayed about the same. So people are still having the issues. You know, this is a discussion for another day. Why was there a decrease in the calls? Why was there a decrease in transports? I don't know, but it certainly didn't seem to move into the critical calls. Now, granted that there's not that big a number, but those numbers have stayed pretty consistent through the 2 years. And in fact, in two of those areas, there was a slight increase. Now, if we look at the cardiac arrests, again, not that many cardiac arrests. And by the way, the cardiac arrests that we look at are only the ones where resuscitation was attempted by units on the scene. It's not people who arrive at scene and find that they meet obvious death criteria. These are only the ones that don't meet that criteria where CPR is started. In this county several years ago, we tried to get a little bit ahead of the curve, that on cardiac arrests where CPR is started, if resuscitation is unsuccessful after 20 minutes, then the paramedics call the base station and can get orders to terminate the resuscitation attempt to leave them at scene. Because after 20 minutes in the field, with the same kind of care they would get in the hospital, by the way, it turns out that there's zero chance of resuscitation at that point. So we're seeing a lot of that. Now, in this, these numbers are pretty low, so it's kind of hard to make any, you know, real determinations out of it. But looking at the 2020 numbers, there were eight. Four of those were transported, but two of those were transported having been on scene and been considered really non-resuscitatable for the 20 minutes, but they were asked to transport them anyway. I'd have to look a little deeper into that to find out why. There are often reasons where that's asked. The other two, where there was what we call ROSC, or return of spontaneous circulation, were transported, but both of those cases expired in the emergency departments, which is, you know, you like to see when you get ROSC, you like to see, you know, that maintained and the people survive. And in fact, we do overall in this county, we've been doing a pretty good job up until last year. We've had a significant drop across the county in our both our ROSC rates and our survival rates in cardiac arrest. And it's going to take some real deep diving in there to figure out exactly why that is. Even though the total number of cardiac arrests that were worked up is an increase, it's about a 12% increase from the previous year, the number of survival went down pretty significantly. So we'll be looking at that as we go forward. We're waiting to get the cardiac arrest data from the state. We belong to what's called the CARE system, or the Cardiac Arrest Registry for Survival. We have all of the, that was one of the things I was able to do during the year, was to at least get all of that information into the CARES database. And we should be getting that yearly report probably in the next 2 to 3 weeks on that. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, why don't we move on to the next? Okay, so we decided to look at trauma calls a little bit. And so these are the trauma calls that were by trauma step, meaning step four, three, two, or one, right? So these are the ones that were transported to met trauma center criteria in one way or another. Step four, as you would imagine, is the one that's going to be the highest. These are, while they meet trauma criteria, are not necessarily critical. And in a lot of cases, it's paramedic judgment, which is written into the trauma criteria. You can see that there was a pretty good drop in the step four consults between 2019, 2020, but a pretty good increase in the number of step threes in 2020 versus 2019. That was interesting. Again, we'll want to, when we have a chance, look a little deeply into that to find out why. Step threes are a little more serious, and there are more specific criteria, you know, for them to meet. I'm not sure why that occurred that way. Step two, the numbers are small enough, you're not going to, you know, see a big difference. Same thing with step ones. They're just not really big numbers to look at. So, you know, you can see this is going up and down. To me, the two that I would want to look at would be the difference between step four and step three. And I don't have any reason why that would have happened. I think it's not a bad thing. You know, it could very well mean that the paramedics in the system are getting better at determining when people meet a higher level of trauma and are being able to make that determination a little better. I don't know. We'll keep watching that, of course, and you know, we'll see what happens over the next year or two as we continue to watch it. Okay, next slide. And then also on trauma, so of course the biggest number of trauma calls you're gonna see are ground level falls. This is by far in everybody's system what you're gonna see most often. And so this represents all ground level falls, not just those that meet trauma criteria. And in fact, if you look at, you know, the numbers, well, first of all, it was a pretty good decrease both in total ground level falls and total ground level falls transported in 2020 versus 2019. But the big difference is the number that met any kind of trauma criteria, and there was only one, and it was a step four in 2020. So there were no step three, two, or ones resulting from ground level falls. And in fact, in 2019, the nine consults were also all step four. So we're still seeing a lot of ground level falls, but that seems to be consistent with the drop in overall call load when you look at it, as opposed to the previous slides, which were dealing with more critical patients, more serious patients. So people are still having heart attacks. There's still cardiac arrest. There are still the more significant trauma. But when you look at the lesser trauma, you know, you're seeing a drop, you know, across the board. I suspect, and again, didn't have a lot of time to pull all this out, but I suspect if you look at the medical calls, you're gonna see a corresponding drop in non-critical medical calls as well. And you know, the big guessing game throughout the next year or two is gonna be to look back at this and say, gosh, why did this happen? Everybody's already scratching their head. We saw this not just in Cambria, but throughout San Luis Obispo County, throughout the state of California, throughout the United States, as a matter of fact, there was a significant decrease in EMS calls everywhere, significant last year. Again, starting with the COVID responses in March, April, and May. And at hospitals, as a matter of fact, our local hospitals at one point mid-year were sending people home because their census were low, the number of people coming to the emergency departments were low, the number of 911 calls were low. Now that's all picked up, but it'll be really interesting to try to get some answers to why that is. Okay, I think that is our last slide. So any questions?
Well, one of the factors for fewer ground level falls might have something to do with countywide training that, for example, Lori Moyer sponsored into our area last year, and I think also the year before, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's been something that public health department has been helping to work on. We try to get them, or they ask us for our EMS ground level fall data. And again, what we can give them is just when people call 911. Most ground level falls end up either walking into an urgent care or to the ER or to their doctors. And so they have to get it out of OSHPED data. But yes, that is a pretty big deal. And they're looking at that pretty carefully. And I know they've instituted, you know, that kind of, you know, local training for communities.
Anyone else have any questions for Mike? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Iggy, could I ask one question to Mike?
Sure.
Because I'm relatively new to the board. I'm not accustomed to what normal looked like before COVID as far as, you know, the reports that you would come and give to us. Is this 20% of what you normally provide? Is this 50%? What, like, how?
The previous reports were done by Doug Brim, who is mm-hmm. no longer with us. He took a position up in Northern California. And Doug is a, you know, he probably should have been an epidemiologist. He has a huge background in statistics. Plus, he worked for the healthcare district. He worked as a paramedic there. So he kind of went above and beyond. I think what you're going to see from us in the future is somewhere in between what Douglas did and what I just did for you here. When we have more time, we can pull out a little bit more data. But we're going to try to get you data which is specific to what our needs would be from the EMSA. A lot of the data that you're going to get from the QI point of view is going to come specifically from the agency. And each agency, each provider agency is required to have a QI plan, and they send somebody to our QI committee, which we, that's the other thing, by the way, we haven't been able to do committee meetings over the last year. We are now putting together a schedule, and we're going to start doing committee meetings again. One of those is our QI group that we do with all of the different providers and a couple of physicians and people from the hospitals, where we look at system QI. And that's our point of view. We're going to look at the system QI issues, like the big overall things. We also ask that each of the agencies present us with a QI plan, and then they can share their individual agency QI with us, and or in the instance of you guys, you know, to your board, or if it's the fire department, to their cities, that kind of thing.
But so I have a question.
Sure.
To Mike, and this is both Mike's maybe, this is Lori. So we have ImageTrend, and my understanding is we can pull out all kinds of data from ImageTrend as an agency. Is that correct? So all of the information you were providing, we also have access to, because you're using the data we submit through ImageTrend to you. My question to you is, if we set up our own QI, who then provides oversight for our QI to make sure that we're appropriate?
That's a complicated question. So that's going to be through us, but we're not going to collect the data. Let me just give you an example. San Luis Ambulance, for example, has to give us response time reports as part of their contract. And they pull their own data and they send it to us. And then we will, throughout the year at times, spot check that to make sure that their data is consistent. And it always has been. We would do the same thing with you guys, but QI from that point of view really is specific to the individual agency. Our oversight is to approve your QI plan. So it's up to the individual agencies to send us a QI plan on what they plan, what they want to do. And then we approve that plan. And then there are other QI policies within the county that deal with things like if there are issues on scene, for example, if there's a request to look at a call from a hospital person, or if we get a complaint, or if we see something through the usual, you know, QI process, and the QI starts person to person, right? So let's say a paramedic unit, Medic 11, takes somebody to the hospital with whatever issue it happens to be. The people at the hospital are concerned with what the treatment might have been. The first thing they will do is pull the paramedic aside and say, hey, why did you make this decision? What did you do over here? And then they'll go back and forth. If the answer isn't good enough, then that hospital can submit a request for a QI review to the EMSA for us to look at. They'll also submit that to the agency, and then we will look specifically at that call. That's how it's done on a regular individual basis. Now, there are other areas, and that's specialty care areas, that we look at. We don't necessarily look at every call, but we do look at everything from the system point of view. For example, there's too many trauma calls to look at, but we are, a part of the trauma committee, the trauma advisory group, and we pull that particular data and work with Sierra Vista Hospital, who is our trauma center. We do the same thing with STEMI, and in STEMI cases, we look at every single call. And again, one of the things I'm trying to do, which we hope to be able to reinstitute this year, is then to review all of those STEMI calls with the individuals at the agencies. Now, it becomes a little more difficult in the QI realm because you can't just send patient data, you know, back and forth to anybody via email. It has to be secured for HIPAA reasons. But we're working on ways to do that, and we want to make sure that we have this follow-up. QI in its purest form is basically a loop, right? So you have a call, somebody sees something that goes on, or you review the call, you look at whatever issues might occur, training is done to correct those issues, and then you put it back into the loop, it's what we call close the loop, and then start all over again. And it's a constant thing. From the agency's point of view, that QI is done at a much more specific level. So for example, you're going to be looking at things like what's the percentage of successful IVs and intubations, how many IOs are done, that sort of thing. At the system level, we're looking at it a little differently, right? So we're looking at primarily the specialty care, how many patients are being transported to the STEMI center that meets STEMI criteria. How many, what's more critical, for example, is how many false negatives do we have? Meaning how many people who end up having a STEMI are sent to the wrong hospital. I will tell you it's very, very low in this county, which is good. But those are the kind of things we measure. We look at overall trauma. We look at the number of step one, two, threes, and fours. And then those calls are reviewed between us and the trauma center. And we look to see how appropriate that was. And again, we look at and measure individual cardiac arrests. So it's more of a system point of view from us, as opposed to the individual part, which is what the individual agencies are supposed to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Does that answer the question? I know it's...
Yeah. It gets,
okay, good.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no other questions, we thank you, Mike, for giving us the rundown, and we'll move on to the ops report, unless we want to let Jeff Minnery go, in which case we should go to agenda item number two, where his input is critical on the California Voting Rights Act resolution. Why don't we do that?
Is there
and then Jeff.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is there any public comment first on that?
Oh, agenda? Yes. We should, if we're going to go to the agenda item E2, yeah, I would call for public comment at this time. Hearing none. Mike McDonough, you want to go ahead and kick that off, please? And then Jeff can chime in.
Sure.
Yep. Absolutely.
I'll have a very, very brief introduction to Jeff because most of this is stuff that he will explain. But basically, the way I understand that there's you're probably are familiar or at least heard of the CVRA, California Voting Rights Act, which is... In a nutshell, where the, for example, our district could be segmented into zones that when it comes time to elect board members, and the public, the community would elect a representative from each separate zone. And so that's kind of the broad overview of what that means.
A little trouble hearing. I don't know if others are having trouble.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Dear. Can you be any closer to the phone? Or?
Yeah, we'll move the mic a little closer here.
I think that it helped. Thank you.
Is that better?
It is.
I can probably speak up a little more. So anyway, it's a redistricting kind of a thing where you chalk right now when we elect or the community elects board members, it's anybody who's a resident in our district can run for our board. This would cut it up into segments, and people in each of those segments would run to represent that piece of the district. I'll let Jeff expound on the complexities and the details of that. but this resolution is related to our response, this district's response to that act.
Thank you. If I might, President Fedorov, directors of the board, I'll make this very brief. Your board received an email along with many of your neighbors requesting how you intended to respond to this California Voters Rights Act. It wasn't a formal demand. Now, the difference between a formal demand comes with it a $30,000 price tag for the plaintiff's attorney who could potentially force your district into a situation of looking at separating out your district into five segments, essentially. And so what this resolution is doing is we're getting ahead of the curve. We're trying to shore up your position, avoid $30,000 that you might have to pay to a plaintiff's lawyer, and your board will make a commitment to look into this issue before the election of November 2022. A lot of districts have taken the same approach. And the next formal step your board would take would be to engage a demographer to determine if this type of cutting up your board from an at-large election, which you currently have, into five separate segments is even valuable, which I think is a question in itself. There is also evolving case law at the California Supreme Court level in regards to this. So I would look at this as a commitment to look into the issue, and we're trying to avoid costs that your board doesn't need to spend on a plaintiff's lawyer.
Jeff, I'm still a little confused as to where this is coming from. Was there a complaint made directly about this healthcare district, or
yes.
Was this?
Okay. Yes. And you received a complaint, not a formal demand, which would come with the price tag of $30,000, but you received an email, as did your neighbors in San Simeon, I know Cayucas, I am blanking on a few others, but it was by the same person who is sent an email to multiple districts, yours included, on the same Friday afternoon, several months ago. And everyone that I know that is similarly situated is responding in this same regard.
And Harry, did the services district get this? Oops, you're muted.
Oh, yes, they did.
They did. Okay.
I had my hand raised. Yes, we have discussed this in closed session and are, let's say, according to our legal counsel, moving cautiously forward as needed. So there you are.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yes. The California Voting Rights Act, is this a new act or has it been out there forever?
It's been out for a few years. I don't know. It's certainly not forever. But I think the original intent was not, I don't believe, targeted at districts of your size or your general demographic makeup, but more for cities in California where there are diverse segments in, you know, you could say a particular part of town that has a particular demographic group. It would not be getting a seat on the board because they couldn't reach that level. But because of this, in my opinion, because of this issue where there's legislation that puts this price tag, it does create an environment where plaintiff's attorneys can, when they get tired of the big fish, they start going after the smaller fish. And
what
I think
does
that's
the plaintiff have to prove to prevail in a lawsuit on this topic?
It's a very low bar right now, but there is a case. So just as a matter of just kind of color to the conversation, the California Voters Rights Act, many cities throughout the state of California started fighting it, saying they didn't want to do it, and everybody lost. Everyone who challenged it lost. Cities spent millions of dollars fighting it. The one example of a city that has recently won, and this was in summer of 2020, so just last year, was the city of Santa Monica. And that case is at the California Supreme Court right now. And so we're monitoring that, which would increase the heightened burden on the plaintiff to show that there actually was a disparate impact on the community. Right now, the bar is very low. And so we are proceeding cautiously. Every dollar counts for your district. You don't have millions of dollars to spend to fight this.
If we pass this resolution, are we committed to have everything in place prior to the election on 2022?
The way the resolution is drafted is that you are committing to put the to consider the issue seriously before 2022.
So okay, we're not, this resolution doesn't mean that we are committed to doing this.
I'm cautious in this situation because we're in open session.
I understand. Okay.
I'm sorry, you cut out. Could you repeat the answer?
I said I am cautious in this situation because we are in open session.
Is this something we should discuss in closed
session? Maybe I'm cutting out.
Yes,
all right. Bill, to simplify it, this is an enabling resolution that enables us to consider segmenting our district. It does not commit us to segment the district. It commits us to consider segmenting the district, and that is all.
Okay, or put another way, we could consider this issue for a number of years.
Well, we have to consider it and come to a conclusion before the 2022 election.
And we will know more before then.
Yeah, we don't have all the facts that we need to have yet.
And the law needs to develop.
Do we know
how much would it cost to hire a demographer?
Yeah. Yeah.
About $20,000.
No, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
And so
to come tell us that we have a very homogenous district.
And so it's, you're looking at, say, to hire a demographer here at $20,000. If we wait till we get a formal demand that forces you to do this, you're going to spend $20,000 on the demographer and another $30,000, which you have to give to the plaintiff's attorney.
Goodness.
So we're trying to get... We're shoring up your position as best as possible and letting the law develop a little bit. But demographers are getting in high demand right now because of this too.
Mm-hmm.
It would seem if we're going to go this route that we should talk with the Cambria Community Service District. And does this affect the Board of the Education?
You're breaking up, Bill.
He asked if the Board of Education would be looking at this too. Coast Unified School District will have to look at this as well.
Everyone's
well,
looking
doesn't
at
it. Doesn't it make sense that we coordinate with the other political entities in town because a demographer needs to build a basic database of the residents of Cambria, and we could share a portion of that cost. I know the boundaries of our district are much larger than either the school district or the service district, but it just makes sense to me that we should not each go out and pay the same $20,000 to a demographer who basically does the same thing once and sells it three times.
Fair point.
You know, I'm looking at Jeff's face, and you should speak for yourself, Jeff, but it feels to me as though he's a little uncomfortable about the depth of our conversation in open session.
Yeah.
Am I reading you wrong?
I'm trying to protect your board by having you adopt a resolution saying that you are going to review this before the November 22 election and try to avoid $30,000 plaintiff's lawyer.
Considering Bill's suggestion will take time, though, right?
Director, I think Director Rice's comments are well taken.
Yeah.
I know San Simeon has just adopted the resolution that you're considering today. My understanding, although I haven't spoken with Mr. Carmel over at Cambria CSD, I think that this concept of a collaborative approach is worth considering.
Mm-hmm. But we're not right there. Now, we need to pass this resolution in order to avoid a plaintiff's lawyer coming in and, you know, alleging that we're not considering this. So we just need to consider.
Okay.
And I'm not saying this is a silver bullet. I'm saying it's the best bullet we have.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just reading some of the language. It looks like it commits us to hiring a demographer.
It does not.
It commits us to consider hiring a demographer. Yeah, I read all.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
And I would suggest any board members call me directly on the issue.
Okay.
If there's no further discussion, I would entertain a motion to approve this resolution as it is written, 17-21.
President Fedoroff, can you confirm that you did take public comment?
I did.
Thank you, dear. I think you did, but I just, thank you.
I did. And no one had any.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
So moved to approve this resolution.
Okay, Lori moved.
Yeah. I second the motion.
Oh, okay. CC seconds.
Right.
All right. Simone, would you please take a roll call?
Vote. Fedoroff?
Yes.
Bill Rice?
Yes.
Lori Millior?
Yes.
Cecilia Montalvo?
Yes.
Cecilia Lamelli?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Now, Jeff, if you want to go to dinner, you're free to go.
Thank you all. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you.
I'll keep my phone on in case something comes up. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate that.
Iggy, if I could just ask real quickly, would someone restate the resolution?
No, it's part of the package. It's an extensive resolution. It's several pages long.
Okay.
And it's in the board packet, Harry.
All right, thank you.
Sure. Okay, so let's move to operations report. Tim Bennis, if he hasn't been called away on a call.
I'm still here. The other crew left.
Okay.
So in regards to that, there was a couple of typos that will be addressed and fixed and noted in the next board meeting. It has to do with mileages on units and fuel consumption. I'm not exactly sure what happened, but there were some typos, so I apologize for that. Update on unit 21. I talked to the body shop today. It'll be decaled by the 20th. It'll be at the decal shop on the 26th. It'll be at the radio shop the following week and hopefully be in service by the 1st of April here for us. We, as I said before, we're going to take the radios out of Unit 17, which I'm hoping we're going to discuss later, surplusing. The radios that are coming out of that ambulance will go into Cal Fire ambulance, thus saving the district a little bit of money. As for the other radios, we're working diligently with the county. I found out today that they have written the software programs that needed to make those radios work. So hopefully they'll be in service shortly. And as for the call volume for this month, because I know everybody likes to know, we've had a total, counting the three transports today already, we've had 26 transports today, and we've had 69 incidences today, as of today. We've had one Monterey County call. We lost one Monterey County call due to both the units being on calls, other calls, and a San Luis ambulance had to respond to Monterey for an incident earlier this month.
Any other questions I can answer for anybody?
Well, I have a question regarding the safety gear. How is it that a set turned up missing?
We're not sure where it turned up missing. We believe that it might have gotten left in the ambulance, and when the unit was in Fresno, it disappeared out of the ambulance in Fresno is our best guess, because we've torn everything apart here looking for it, and we cannot find it anywhere.
But and how much is one of those worth?
The jacket was, I believe, about $250, and the Hummer was about $210 plus the light. So roughly around $700 worth of equipment that was lost. But we don't know where it disappeared at.
Okay, well, maybe the grant that we got for the radios can help pay for the safety gear.
Yeah.
So my suggestion is, when you have to buy that, ask the trust to pay for it. Okay.
Okay. We have honestly looked everywhere. I've sent out multiple emails. None of our crews have it. That's our best guess, is that incident with 18 going to Fresno is where it turned up missing, which is sad because it was at a fire station. But there's no cameras, so we can't prove anything.
Okay. All right. Any questions for Mike?
You want to give him today?
You mean for
Any other questions I can try to answer for anybody?
And you were at 100% on the response time. I like that.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Okay, let's move on then to the administrator's report, please.
All right. Okay, Darren. All right, you've got my report. Just real briefly, a couple of high points. My glasses keep fogging up. Sorry about that. Sure, you can't see what you're doing. Where was I? We're finishing up the public assistant grant, which is good. We've had a lot of help from our friend at...
You need to speak more clearly, Mike.
Oh, sorry. Is that better?
Okay. Well, try it.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, good. you've got the latest stats on my report as far as the COVID stats and so forth. We have been moved, our county has been moved into tier two, which is good news. And my understanding is we're actually in the next tier. If we stay there for a total of 2 weeks, then officially it becomes official. And that was, I think, a week ago. So I think we're really close to clicking into the next tier, which is good news. I'm real happy about that. Let's see. Our tax revenue was down below budget, but the county's still having a little bit of a lag. I talked to them and they're working on it. We did send the money in for Unit 21's paint job, so that is noted there. That's no big deal. I'm looking for anything that's we had budgeted for the election costs. We didn't get the invoice last month. We got it this month. So actually, that in my next report, you'll see that money was that invoice was paid in March instead of February, as we thought. And it was a little less than 10,000. It was 8,000 and something, 8,400 or something right around that amount. And that's been taken care of. The only other thing really is on my performance objectives, we've accomplished some, we've made some progress on a lot of these items, which I've listed there. The audit, just a quick comment on that, very close. We're getting closer day by day, doing some fine tuning. We've essentially done what we need to do at this point. Our bookkeeper and the auditor are exchanging communications to dial in, the AR, I believe. And we're hoping to have that ready for you by next board meeting to present to you. still fogging up my glasses. Let's see. Oh, and you know, we continue as far as the employee relation stuff. We've continued with the monthly meetings. That's worked out real well, especially having a board member attend. The employees really appreciate that. It's improving communications with them, between them and the board. As you know, the 360 process was completed, and I replied back to the general population of the employees, and that seems to be well received from what I've seen. And I initiated a employee engagement survey, 45 questions, and that closes the end of this month, and I'll be able to report the results to the board in total, the statistics on that next month. So,
are you continuing your shift change?
Yeah.
Meeting with the employees?
Yeah, each morning I go out at shift change and do the water cooler thing, you know, just, hi, how you doing? How are things going on? I enjoy that, and hopefully they enjoy it. I don't know. But it seems to be helping. I've had some feedback from the employees.
Are you going to consider doing that at the 8 p.m. shift change?
On occasion, that's a little different because I saw them that morning and they just are going home that evening. you know, like there's not another crew.
Oh, you're okay. Yeah. It's
not really a shift change. It's a shift end. And,
yeah.
If we did have back-to-back 12s like some places, then yeah, if there was a new crew coming in, I would try to touch with them.
Okay.
We don't
understand.
Have a new crew coming. I'm kind of starting down the pathway to work on the new budget for the new fiscal year. Actually, today and tomorrow is the second day of the webinar. I engaged in a webinar from CSDA on budgeting for administrators. So, working on that skill set. More on that later as that unfolds. I did say that there was a goal to work on improving QI, which we talked about earlier with Michael. I've set up some quarterly meetings with the QI coordinators from Sierra Vista and French. So Tim and I and them will meet on Zoom and talk about QI issues. You know, how are we doing? Is there any suggestions for improvement, et cetera, et cetera. So they've been very receptive, and I think that's going to work out.
Will Sierra Vista speak for Twin Cities then?
Yes. Yeah, Sierra Vista primarily because the larger hospital and they're the trauma center. But yes, they represent Twin Cities as well. I've also done the same thing with County Mental Health. There was some question about us improving or working on how can we assist this community's mental health, especially in the areas of youth, teen suicides, teen mental health issues, those kind of thing. And so I've reached out to the county's behavioral health staff, and they've been very receptive, and we've set up a Zoom meeting with them as well. So we can see if there's kind of an outreach, you know, is there things that we can do that would help them in their mission with mental health in our community?
Excuse me.
Yes.
I have a group that's already started with teenagers. It starts this month, and they meet on Zoom. And one of our local therapists, Shelly Triggs, is the one involved with that. So we have about 20 kids right now.
Okay.
And so every week we're referring children over. They're basically middle school. And so middle school and some high school, but we focus on middle school right now. So just heads up.
Cool. The only other comment I got on there is just that there, you know, the a quick mention on the primary care project. The RFP is closed as of last Friday. We've got a meeting set up this Thursday with the ad hoc committee to review those options, and they will. The outcome should be a report to the board on what their recommendations are moving forward. Any questions?
Any board members have any questions for Mike?
I do. I'm still learning, as you know, but in listening to Mike who presented earlier, it sounds to me as though we do have ourselves a whole lot of quality statistics at our fingertips. And I think that I mean, I can speak for myself, but the entire board approved the strategic plan. I think very, very important that the board itself be looking at patient care quality. And so I think that, and that's one of your objectives, Mike. And I don't think that the board reports that you've worked on provide the quality data. I think that we're getting volumes, we get response times is the one that we get. But as you mentioned, there's kind of a standard set of quality metrics for the service. And I think the board wants to see those, how we're doing.
As the presenter from EMSA said, it's up to the district to come up with a QI plan, and then EMSA would approve that QI plan, and then it's up to us to maintain reporting on it. And I think that's what Cecilia is getting at.
Sure. We do have a QI plan. Talked briefly with Tim. It's in need of updating, and we can work on that. One of the methods, I guess is a better word, is something called KPI, key performance indicators. And you measure those metrics, you know, whether it's IV success rates or whatever. What I need to do is work with one or more board members to kind of, in other words, we can report, I can generate a QI report that has a lot of information. It may be cumbersome or more than what the board would like to look at. So if the board would help me identify what KPI report, what would you like to see in that report? Do you want to know each individual paramedic's IV success rate? And you say, well, no, not necessarily. But are there benchmarks? Are they above or below those benchmarks?
I would think that a way to get input on that, Mike, is to give us a list of what can be reported on.
Yes.
And then ask for input from each board member. And then I think between maybe CC and Cecilia, or maybe CC and Lori, maybe we could form an ad hoc committee to determine which quality indicators would be reported on a regular basis.
Absolutely.
That's my suggestion anyway.
No, that's a good idea. Making a note to self.
Yeah, I think that process is going to get us where I think we want to be. And I know Cece, you're really busy, but I think your clinical education probably is super important in looking at quality metrics.
And again, you typically, what I've seen in the past is you don't report just raw numbers because that just, you know, make a head spin.
You have
these benchmarks and then you report if we're above or below, kind of like what you do with our, Tim says, you know, we're at 100% compliance this month. He's not giving you all the raw numbers. He's just saying, you know what, we're at 100% or we're at 96% or whatever of our response time. You know, that's one benchmark. But we could do the same thing with medical quality assurance indicators, KPI indicators, and set those benchmarks and then report to the board based on what you say is important, you know, things that are important to you. Are we above or below the standard, basically? So absolutely, I'll work on that. That would be very helpful.
Any other questions or comments for Mike? Okay, I'm going to move on then to committee reports. First off, on mine, I have basically two items to report on. First of all, a meeting has not been held among CCSD, CUSD, and CCHD, simply because we haven't had an issue of mutual interest to discuss. The only thing that came close to that was how much CCSD would charge us to put out the flyer for the strategic plan. And I was very heartened to see that when I opened my mail, that the CCHD plan was the first thing that came into view. I don't think that was intentional, but I was happy that that was the case. Yeah, and for those directors who aren't aware of it, we got charged less than $300 to do that, and that was great. San Simeon Community Services District didn't charge us anything, but considering the number of mailers and the fact that CCSD contracts out for the service, that was a very reasonable charge. The other issue is one that Mike reported in his weekly activity report on Friday, that Jeff, Bill Avery, Mike, Jim, and I had a Zoom meeting to discuss the issue of having employees get vaccinated for COVID. And I simply urge all employees of the district to be vaccinated. My wife and I have both been vaccinated with the worst thing happening, that I think I ran a temperature of 100.6 after my second vaccine. And those that would say, well, you know, I have a problem with getting flu vaccines or other vaccines that use dead virus or use chicken albumin as a medium for administering the vaccine or carrying the vaccine. This is messenger RNA, totally new approach, has no dead virus in it. As far as I know, does not use albumin as a medium. And I mean, my wife had absolutely no impact except a slight headache the next morning after her second vaccination and a sore arm. So for those that are reading statistics that whose provenance is not certified as correct. For example, the CDC website has a statistical database that anybody can report on, or into, I should say. So if I want to say my wife died as a result of receiving the COVID-19 vaccination, I could do so. And it would be posted in that website. That's not something that I urge anyone to put much stock in. Anybody that resists doing it simply because it's some new technology, I think it's much, much more important for all of us to be vaccinated and be able to enjoy getting back to life as we knew it before the pandemic. So that's my two cents. If anybody wants to agendize this subject for April, let Mike know or let me know and we'll agendize it. But for the time being, we're asking the employees to get vaccinated, but we're not insisting on it at this point.
So can I add something to AD's comments, please?
After
a conversation today with EMSA, they're in the works of adopting the new CDC guidelines. And one of the incentives for employees is if all the employees that are in the office or a room have the COVID vaccine, they will not be required to wear a mask. They can if they want to, but they won't be required to wear a mask. They'll still be required to wear it on calls and in the public. So the CDC, for people who have the vaccine, they're kind of loosening the guidelines a little bit as an incentive to get people to get the vaccine. Now, if one person in the room doesn't have the vaccine, then everybody still has to wear a mask that's in that room.
But if everybody's in that room has the vaccine, then they can actually not have, they're not forced to wear a mask at that time. They have the option to, but they don't have to.
Okay, that's my report. Anybody have any questions from the board? Okay, let's move on then to property and facilities. Lori?
We did not meet, but we do have a meeting planned for March 29th, and we'll be meeting with Bruce Beery as well as a representative from Veneer Construction.
Just
to look at some options for moving forward with improving crew quarters.
I would also like you to consider the state of the paint on our facility.
Okie doke.
Exterior.
Okay.
Yeah, every time I visit the office, I notice that down around the ground level, you know, where water comes up and hits the paint, it's deteriorating a little bit.
Okay. All right. Will do.
Any other questions for Lori or comments? Healthcare advocacy and outreach, Cecilia.
So that committee has not met, but Mike and I discussed that as soon as we have the primary care group up and that work kind of bundled up, I'm going to collaborate with Cece to figure out what our agenda will be going forward, and we will have one of those meetings.
Okay. Any questions for Cecilia? Finance, Bill Rice.
We did not have a meeting since the last board meeting. We will probably have a finance committee meeting once we get a final draft of the audit report for the finance committee to approve and then present it to the board.
Okay. Any questions for Bill? When are you expecting the first draft of the budget, Bill?
I think that's a question of, for Mike, he's taking the lead on it this year.
Sounds kind of silly. As soon as possible. I believe, if I remember correctly from last year, it's usually presented to the board in May?
No, it's presented to the board in June, but it'd be better to get at it in April, frankly.
I'm shooting for sooner than later so that I can, you know, work with Bill if there's any adjustments. So, like I said, I've already kind of begun the process with taking this webinar this week and doing some studying up on how to do that accurately. So I'm not waiting till June. So hopefully I can get it to you before.
Okay, so I guess what I would say to all board members, if you have an expense that you envision hitting us in fiscal year 2021-22, send a note to Mike.
Yes, that's a good point, Iggy. There's a process, like I said, I was learning today about that. And part of that is kind of a poll where I will poll the board and they call it stakeholders. So that could include even the public and the employees as to perceived needs for budget items, expense items, whatever. So I'll be giving in that process pretty soon so I can get that going.
Okay. Grants, Lori.
We did not meet this month or last month.
Okay. And we have, Mike, we have submitted everything that we need to submit on the AFG grant and also the PPE grant, whatever that's called.
Yeah, the AFG grant is all, it's done. It's in the hopper. Nothing to do there but wait. Funds from the county for the vaccinations we submitted an invoice last week. So for $11,000 something. So that's done. And that'll be done each month. We'll submit a new invoice as it moves forward. And then the PAG, I'm meeting with Tim and Jeremy this Thursday to wrap that up and get that in the hopper. So we're very close to get that submitted. And it's in the neighborhood of $65,000 for that, the PAG.
And CC, you've gone to your management to get compensation for our support of the CHC vaccination event Saturday before last?
No, I did not, because I was understanding that it was a volunteer position from both volunteers from both paramedics. I was not informed that that was going to be a cost. I found out after the event. I came to Mike on Monday and there was no mention about any cost. So we are not prepared to pay that amount. No. Let me finish. On Monday, when I asked Mike, I came over and asked if we would like to partner with the EMS system. I was told nothing about any payment. And they said, there's Tim. I talked to Tim. He was there also. There was no discussion about any amount of money. That's what I was known, and that's all I know at this time.
And I'll take responsibility for not following up. It was my misunderstanding. I thought at the time that this was part of the county's system where we have a contract with them for providing vaccination support, and I could include that in the invoice. I subsequently found out that's not the case. So I should have.
Did you not ask CC if she had coordinated with the county?
I did, but I said, you know, I asked the question if, have you contacted the county? Are they aware of what you're doing? And she said yes, because she had a conversation with them. I should have confirmed with the county that what I was talking about was different than what she was talking about. She was talking about just, you know, that she was connected to them as far as they knew that CHC was going to put on the vaccinations. I thought that meant that they were an approved county site, like what they call a pod. Subsequently, I found out that wasn't the case. So I will be more careful in the future about that kind of detail.
Okay,
We were given monies through a grant to provide services for our community in Cambria. So we find out about vaccines at a very short time. We had people on lists that we were calling on Thursday and Friday to get people to come in to get their vaccines. We're hoping to do more vaccine clinics, but at this time, it was a separate event from the healthcare district. We asked that the EMS help us. We wanted to partnership. We wanted to show that we work together as a community to provide a service for our residents. And that's all I was thinking of. I came to Mike and Mike said, sure. And I talked to Tim and we worked together to provide that service. So it was PR not only for us as Community Health Center, but also for the healthcare district, that we're partners. We work together to provide a service for our community. And that's
we're partners with the county as well. But we bill them.
And that was my
there's a billing rate.
It was on Friday before that and before the event on Saturday. And that was my intent, was to help out. But I should have done some more checking with the county as far as what the details were.
Lori, you had a question?
Well, no, I had a comment. And I think it's great that CHC is able to offer vaccines to their patients, but it's to your patients. And that's separate.
No, you're misunderstood.
Excuse me, let me finish, please.
Yeah, you can finish. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Because you were calling your patients and saying you can come down for a vaccine, and it wasn't something that was announced community-wide. I appreciate you didn't have a lot of time to do that, but you need to appreciate that it costs. We are underwriting the cost of having our staff be there. And I'm assuming through your grant that that your staff is being paid to come in.
That's not true. We're all volunteers, number one. Number two, we had a list of patients already. We also did some with Dr. Gong's patients. We did some with Dr. Griffin's patients. It wasn't just, we didn't know how many vaccines we got until Thursday night. We were calling patients on Thursday and Friday night to get them to do the vaccines. The same thing was this last Saturday, and we don't know when we'll have vaccines again. We just keep working with patients here locally. Some of them are Dr. Gong's patients. Some of them are Dr. Dave Griffin's patients. Some of them are patients who are not in a Ragged Point. We have patients from Cayucas. It's all different patients that we're trying to locate and get them in. We ask that we partnership. I did not know about the cost. If I had known, I would have not done it because we are not going to pay for that. We are not paying for our employees. I am volunteering my time.
Okay. Have you contacted the medical volunteer medical corps as well for volunteers?
No, because us as our as we as staff want to do this. We want to do it for our patients. So we are there working and supplying it for people. So we do not expect to be paid, and we want to do this for our community.
There are members of our community who are part of the volunteer medical corps who might also be willing to help volunteer and help you out.
We had a very short time to do these vaccines.
Okay.
The CERT came forward and offered their services. We were very helpful for CERT. We were very helpful for Tim and the paramedic that was with us. We're very helpful for as many volunteers, but it was a very short time and notice that we got. That's okay. All I can say.
Chrissy had her hand up, by the way. She's muted, though.
Yes, I would, as Cece just said, the community emergency response team under the direction of the fire department was at both of the clinics that we had. We had traffic control. We had people who were helping with medical observation. After the patients were given their vaccinations, we had for the first clinic, we had 18 people that were there helping. And for last Saturday when we were there, we had 17 people. They are all volunteers and they are all people who live here in Cambria. As far as what Cece is saying about the patients that were given these vaccinations, they were not just limited to the CHC patients. As she said, Dr. Gong's patients, Dr. Griffith's patients, some of the patients that were able to get in were high-risk patients that had no other way to get to the clinics. And I would like to ask how much that charge is and if it is a charge for a standby fee for the ambulances to be there or if you are charging specifically for the EMT people that were there.
Chrissy, there's a standard fee. We signed a contract with the county. Mike did.
Yeah.
And the board of directors approved it. And there's a standard charge for a paramedic and a standard charge per hour, an hourly charge for an EMT. And that's all the invoice was for. It was for 8.5 hours of an EMT and of a paramedic. And that amounted to just under $1,000. All right, we'll move on.
Okay.
Strategic planning, Cecilia?
Did not meet.
Okay, and then your ad hoc committee has been formed for the proposal review?
Yes, I think that's actually agendized later, Iggy. So
okay, yeah.
A little bit
item,
more to say about
item E6. Yeah. Okay, we'll move on then to item E3. Part-time reserve ambulance staff wage analysis. Do we have any public comment on that? Hearing none, you're up, Mike McDonough.
Thank you. The board had requested that I look into this issue. As you know, a number of months ago, we were able to...
Can you put the microphone closer to you, Mike? I can't hear you.
Sorry. Is that better? Can you hear me now? Okay. Anyway, a number of months ago, we were able to reach agreement and have a new MOU agreement with the full-time staff. And the idea was once that was accomplished, we would turn our attention to the part-time wages and their comparison and so forth and so on. So I started to work on that recently. And you can see in the packet, the information there. Essentially, there has not been an increase in the part-time EMT and paramedic wages for well over 10 years. And so historically, they've fallen behind as far as the prevailing wages and our full-time wages in comparison. So I took a look at that, and what I've presented to you here is a proposal or an estimate of what the cost would be to bring them up into somewhat the realm of possibility of being competitive with the prevailing wage in the area. We would still be below, and if you look on the subsequent pages, I've put in San Luis Ambulance's rates in comparison with this proposal, and below that are current full-time rates as well. So you can kind of see the whole picture. We would still be below San Luis Ambulance, but we would catch up quite a bit to bring it into the picture. Part of this is not just the wages. The bigger picture here is that Tim's efforts to, recruit and retain part-time employees is important, and he has struggled with that primarily because of the hourly rate being so low here. People that work full-time elsewhere, in order to entice them to come here and fill part-time shifts, if we're not competitive, then the incentive isn't there to come here. So you end up with full-time staff filling open shifts for whether it's sick or vacation or whatever. And of course, as you know, full-time staff is fairly expensive because they're getting overtime. So this would potentially reduce overtime costs on the full-time side, and also increase Tim's ability to recruit and retain and reduce turnover, which turnover is expensive because of training and uniforms, et cetera, et cetera. All of those things considered. So I did crunch some numbers, which you can see on the page 42 at the top left, of basically three proposals, a 10% catch-up for the first year, and then years two and three, 5%, which is in line with the 5% increases in our full-time MOU. And then there's a 20%, the second proposal shows 20%, and the third proposal is 30%. So that you can see how that compares to San Luis Ambulance part-time rates as well as our full-time rates. Any questions about that?
Mike, you made the point that many times the 12-hour shift needs to be filled by some of our full-time employees, in which case they get overtime pay.
Yes,
and correct. And quite expensive. And I did not, if you had had time to look to see if you could come up with a figure in exactly how much we've been paying in overtime to fill those shifts.
Yeah, I talked with Tim about that, and we can do that, but it's going to be a manual process. We don't have the database capability to just pull that up on the computer. We would have to go back and pull all the time cards for, say, the past year or two, three, and just manually go through them and see where it says on a, say, a full-timer's time card, overtime on Medic 12, for example. We can do that, but it's going to take more time.
But you did provide us with hourly rates, so we can see what the paramedic overtime rate is, what the EMT overtime rate is.
Correct.
So on.
I think it's an extremely important number to make a decision about this, because if you knew that the offset in savings for not paying overtime was $15,000. I'm just throwing out a number. I think the board would be interested in doing therefore more, knowing that, we could push the cost a little bit. I have a hard time deciding what's right here. What I was surprised about was how far below we are.
Exactly.
And that includes the labor negotiations we had. I specifically remember during that discussion that I thought we were provided data that showed that we were on par. And I'm seeing that we're not even close.
Well, with, you mean as far as our full-time staff?
Yeah.
Versus, yeah. Well, if you look
well,
at...
Well, our full-time staff has a number of benefits that San Luis Ambulance doesn't offer their employees.
Right.
So
and,
that,
oh, that's right, because they have keep, helpers, yeah.
Yeah, and keep in mind the SLAS, where you see the SLAS numbers on the top right part of the page, that is their part-time pay.
No. Which,
yeah, that's not their full-time pay.
No.
Scale.
Actually, excuse me, I have to interject because I do work part-time at San Luis Ambulance. San Luis Ambulance doesn't have a part-time and full-time pay scale. They work off of years of licensure. So what they work off of is how many years have you been an EMT? How many years have you been a paramedic?
Mm-hmm.
We do years of service. So an eight-year paramedic, if a paramedic comes in and has had their paramedic card for 8 years, they'll get paid those rates that you see, either the 4802 or the 3936. What San Luis Ambulance does is the first 24 hours is a time and a half of the pay period for a reserve paramedic. So if a reserve paramedic works 36 hours or a 48-hour shift, the first 24 of it is paid at time and a half. Then the second and any corresponding shift for the remainder of that pay period, which is 2 weeks, is paid at whatever rate they work. If they work a 24-hour ambulance, it's paid at that. If they work a 12-hour ambulance, it's paid at that. They get paid 24-hour rates for standbys and LDs. So if they take a transfer to UCLA or something, they're paid hour for hour at the 24-hour rate.
But just to clarify, these are the time and a half rates. This is their full-time.
You took those in time? Okay.
I took the full-time rates, and this is time and a half, which is their, what, like Tim said, if a part-time person comes in and works a 24-hour shift, that's the rate they'll get for that first.
Okay, and so to confirm, the dollar amount, the hourly dollar amount shown on line 8 for 12 hours, that's time and a half, $48 an hour.
Correct, yeah, and that, and for part-timers, so that's not their full-time, their full-time rate would be minus 1.5 of that, if you know.
Well, divided by 1.5.
Yeah, divide by 1.5. Sorry.
I apologize. Yeah. I didn't realize that he had done that.
Yeah, because I was trying to compare part-time to part-time. You know, our part-time rates versus their part-time rates.
Mm-hmm.
And the differences there.
I think you need...
I'm sorry.
Some information here. I agree.
Oh, you're
that we, an analysis of the savings on overtime.
Gosh,
and kind of alluded
to you're breaking up, Bill.
That she needed that in. Are we breaking up?
Yeah, you
are.
Sorry.
Okay, so if I understand correctly, and I agree with it, but what we need to do is study how much we rely on full-time staff to fill shifts that could be filled by part-timers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that that's a very objective process. I think you have to.
Isn't all overtime? It wouldn't all overtime fall into that category, or no?
No, there's overtime that is
normal scheduled overtime.
Normal scheduled overtime.
Yeah, when they work in a say, for example, they work what's called a 24 hour crew works what's called a 56 hour week schedule. So that's 40 hours of straight time, 16 hours of time and a half. Routinely, that's what they just do their shifts and go home. So that's why I can't just go to our payroll vendor mm-hmm. and say, show me all the overtime for the last 12 months of all our full-time staff, because it's not a clear picture of what we're talking about. We're going to have to manually go back through time cards and look for where the person wrote in, I worked medic 12 on my day off. I came in and worked medic 12 and got overtime, true overtime, which you would call
right.
Overtime.
So that's one aspect. Another aspect is what Tim reported in his ops report this month, where he had scheduled interviews with potential EMTs and potential paramedics. And when it came time to actually conduct the interview, they backed out once they learned what the scheduling was like and what the pay rate was.
Yeah.
And I think on more than one occasion, at least one of the employees that's participated in Mike's monthly employee discussions has mentioned that the $17 per hour rate, if I remember the rate correctly, hasn't been changed in quite a number of years. And well, as you can see, there's nothing even close to $17 in the San Luis ambulance
right
numbers.
I think it's critically important that we do something about this. Don't get me wrong. I just feel like I need to know what the net cost is. I don't even know how you would do the budget.
It's difficult to give you an exact number, but we could try. For example, one thing I did do is I pulled the budgets from the last 3 years, just the overall total budget costs. And because we list full-time, part-time, and 2000, hang on, get to the right page here. Oh, there's 20. So 18, okay, I got 18, 18. So 2018, for example, part-time, what we spent for part-time was $128,000 was our, and that's just labor costs. That's just, that doesn't take into account, you know, other factors. Interestingly, and I'm not real sure, except I was talking to him about this earlier, 2019, a year later, we spent $86,000 in part-time costs, part-time wages. And then in 2020, it went to $123,000 for the year. The only thing we can think of is in 2019,
we have more full-time staff covering.
Yeah.
Then we have part-time staff covering.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, a lot of this is our best intuition from talking to people, you know, why are we doing it? And we have actually, since I've been here, there's not often, thankfully, because Tim just is a beast when it comes to working. But there's been a couple of times where we've had to brown out that unit, Medic 12. He's saying seven times. Where we just didn't have the staff. So during the day, there was one ambulance simply from staffing. And he's tried everything to cajole, coerce, whatever, to get part-timers to come in. And they're going, well, you know.
there was some point in 2019. Oh, sorry. There was actually several points in 2019 where we had one full-time staff member who offered to cover so we could have both ambulances staffed and running. And we paid him double time to make sure that we had ambulances covered on weekends. So we haven't done that since. I put a kibosh to that because I wasn't the one who made that ultimate decision. But it was kind of highway robbery and that employee no longer works here. But you know, it was a decision that was made based on the fact that it was a weekend, it was warm weather, and if we didn't, we wouldn't have that ambulance covered. Yeah. And that ambulance actually ran calls. Every time we did it, that ambulance transported at least two patients. So we made money, but we kind of broke even and didn't have the county coming going, hey, what's going on? But every time that I did have to brown an ambulance out, I had to contact Vince, I had to contact county, MedCom, and I had to contact San Luis Ambulance because that meant that put an extra strain on their system to bring an ambulance up into Cambria when we ran calls. Every time that ambulance was dispatched, the Medic 11 ambulance was dispatched, we were waiting and hoping that a San Luis ambulance didn't have to respond into Cambria. Because San Luis Ambulance's first responsibility is San Luis Ambulance's area. So that's the other thing that we have to think about.
Tim, you know, Tim and I have had some pretty long conversations about this. You know,
need to speak up, Mike.
Oh, sorry. We hire full-time from our part-time staff. That's our system. And in years past, when there was a full-time opening, there was a lot of people on the part-time list that said that, you know, pick me, they wanted to get there. His recent experience, like you mentioned earlier, AD, was he had an opening for paramedic, full-time opening, and had one part-timer who went through the process to get that position. And that's unusual. Normally there would be a very competitive process. So I think it's, my assessment is, after talking to Tim, we're at kind of a tipping point that something, and I, you know, like Cecilia said, you know, it's pretty obvious we need to do something. What that something is up to the board.
Tim, did you get a feel for how much or what it would take to attract the number of candidates that you've seen in the past?
There would have to be an increase in the pay, but also I know Lori and I and everybody has been kind of dancing around the second 24-hour car, but that would be the second thing that we have to look at, is not only increasing the part-time pay, but bringing back that second 24-hour ambulance, because that's what they want to do. They don't want to come up here and work for 12 hours for the amount of pay we're paying them. If we increase the part-time pay, they may actually want to come up and work for the 12-hour shifts, and we wouldn't have a problem. But those are the two big deciding factors with our reserve staff, is one, the 12-hour car, nobody wants to work it. They don't even want to work it. The people that work at San Luis Ambulance don't want to work the 12-hour car there for considerably more money than we're paying our 12-hour medics here. And they don't want to work a 24-hour shift here because it's only $17 an hour, and they go to Panda Express or McDonald's or any place like that, and they see that they're starting them out at, you know, $17, $18 an hour for an 8-hour shift.
Yeah.
So my question is, did you get a sense for how much we have to increase to attract the number of candidates that you'd want to have?
No, sir. I did not get a sense. Is they say an increase.
All right, so I guess what we need is additional information in terms of what this might cost in terms of net cost. Mike's given us what the gross cost would be to increase 10, 20, and 30%, but not the savings associated with those increases. So somehow you guys need to get your heads together and see if there's a way to figure out what the savings might be.
I will start going through the time cards over the next couple of days and pull all the full-time staff and calculate how many hours they've worked, whether it was a 12 or a 24, and their pay rate for that time that they worked on the ambulance, and have it for the board before the next meeting.
Great.
I have one other request on this, because I really do think we have a big gap to fill. Our budget is like, there's not today, I mean, Bill's having trouble speaking, but we all know that it's razor thin, right?
Yeah.
And so do we have any idea where in our budget this is going to get absorbed?
Or does it need to wait to the beginning of the next fiscal year?
Yeah,
your professional opinion?
When it is budget.
Yes, your professional opinion is what, Tim?
I think that we should look at this, but I don't think we should act on anything until the next fiscal year when we can plan for it. The crews are stepping up. We're handling it right now. The next fiscal year is only a couple months away. So why shoot ourselves in the foot when we're finally making headway?
Yeah, that was my intent, was that if this is approved or any version of it, it would not be put in effect until July of this calendar year, or the first month of our new fiscal year. I would build it into the new budget. So.
Yeah, I mean, it would just be good to see how you're able to make room for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things you have to remember is that we spent a good deal of money this year on equipment that hadn't been replaced in a long time.
Right.
So
that's true.
Hopefully we can find some room to increase part-time employee pay.
Right. But we'll get you that data for if it's the will of the board. I would suggest that we table this till next month and we come back with those details. Because I was kind of starting this process early so that we could work on this for the new fiscal year budget process.
Okay. Do we have any objection to Mike's suggestion?
I think it's a good one.
Okay. So this will be on the agenda for April. Okay. Item E4. Is there any public comment regarding the status of Unit 17?
All about 10.
Hearing none. Sorry?
This is Tim, Steve.
Okay, Tim, go ahead.
So as we've talked about many times before, Unit 17, I'm requesting that it be taken out of service and surplus. Originally, my belief is that with the amount of work that needs to be done for the vehicle and the cost of the vehicle, the mileage on the vehicle, it would not be worth even attempting to sell. We've had some people who have come forward now and expressed interest in trying to purchase the vehicle. I don't know what the potential value is. We figure maybe between $2,000 and $3,000, but there's no guarantee of that. What I would suggest, or what I would like to propose to the board, is that we surplus the ambulance. We take the parts that we can take off of it, sell what we can sell that we won't use, that we have some lights and some other parts and pieces that don't fit any other of the other units that we currently have in our fleet and we won't be using in our fleet. Sell those as surplus, use them and put that money back into the kitty. Attempt to try and auction the unit off as is. If we get some money for it, great. If we don't, then the second option is to just take it to a junkyard and have it recycled at that point. It's not a safe unit to be sent out to anybody in service as an ambulance. And I've explained, you know, multiple times, there's corrosion all over it. It's led its life and it's on its way out. So if the board agrees, we would like to go ahead and surplus this. We'll take all the equipment that we can salvage off of it for unit 16, sell what we can't sell and get rid of the rest so that we don't have something sitting in the back of the station that is utterly useless that we're paying insurance and stuff on.
Anybody have any questions? If not, I would entertain a motion to surplus Unit 17 and follow the required procedures regarding surplus. I think it has to be offered up to other government agencies for a specified amount of time. And then we can hold an auction. It does not have to be a in-person auction. It could just be noticed appropriately. And I think Mike should know how to do that. Anyway, I would entertain a motion to surplus Unit 17.
I move to surplus Unit 17.
Okay, Cecilia?
Second.
Lori seconds.
Thank you.
sorry?
Ken said thank you.
I just said thank you.
Oh.
we haven't voted right yet.
Simone, would you do a roll call vote, please?
Yes. Iggy Fedoroff?
Yes.
Bill Rice?
Yes.
Lori Millior?
Yes.
Cecilia Montalvo?
Yes.
Cecilia Monoy?
Yes.
Okay. No, thank you. One less headache.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on then to agenda item E5, preemptive upstaffing proposal. Do we have any public comment? Hearing none, Mike, this is your item.
Yes, we have been examining, and you've got some data in the subsequent pages that you can review. The concern is the upcoming holiday weekend coverage due to various factors, Tim is anticipating that we might be quite busy on these upcoming Memorial Day. 4th of July is on a Sunday this year, so 4th of July weekend and so on through the summer season. The community has noticed an increase in traffic flow of tourism. I spoke with one gentleman at one of the local restaurants, and he says they're seeing numbers that are higher than pre-COVID. So
yeah.
People are flocking to our community. That usually results in increased call volume for us and preparation. Similar to what Tim arranged for the recent storm, where we upstaffed. By upstaff, we mean taking the 12-hour car and turning it into temporarily into a 24-hour car. So we have the two 24-hour units on the holiday weekend, say Friday, Saturday, Sunday evening. The cost estimates are in your packet. I crunched the numbers as far as the labor cost of upstaffing, and I used kind of a worst case scenario. I took our two highest paid EMT and paramedic crew as my example, and you're looking at per 24-hour period, $360 roughly, and then of course housing them at the local hotel, like we did for the storm, approximately $300 per evening. So for a weekend, we're looking at just under $2,000 to staff them. And if the unit ran even one call, it would be covered by the revenue of that one call. So I think that financially, it's a smart move. And even more importantly, operationally and tactfully, it is a good move for the community that will be better prepared for those anticipated traffic flows that we're looking at. And again, in the discussion points, we've got a lot of information there. If we get increased Monterey County calls, we're already concerned about that because of the landslide up north, and the campgrounds are opening up, that we may see increased traffic flows well into Monterey County. And if we get calls there, of course, that's going to impact us as well. And then the last bullet point on page 45 is interesting and talking about, you know, the other intangibles. These are non-financial items, just the community's confidence in what we're doing. It provides some backup for the normal 24-hour crew, the Medic 11. So that they're not just up all night long. You know, one of the things that to think about is we saw in the storm, not only do we anticipate potentially running more calls in our district, but in the neighboring communities, Cayucas, Morro Bay, and so forth, that we would give us another unit at night to provide that resource to the county as they potentially would have an uptake in call volume because of these holiday weekends. I'm not even sure. I can try and find out if 4th of July weekend, if Cayucas is going to do fireworks or anybody else. I haven't been able to find that answer, but I know even last year when COVID kind of shut everything down and they didn't have the parade in Cayucas, they kind of had one anyway. there was people that came and just kind of did their own thing. So with the relaxing of restrictions combined with the itch for people to come to the coast, I think the whole coastline could be very busy. So anyway, that's kind of it in a nutshell. Hopefully you've had a chance to review some of the historical data. Jeremy did a great job of putting together going back, 3 years, I think. By day of the week, so you can see the uptick on the weekends and call not only call data but also transport data.
Mike, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
You said the estimated cost, say for Memorial Day weekend, is just under $2,000, and you said even one ambulance transport would cover that. Mm-hmm. If it's a Medicare transport, it wouldn't cover it.
That's true.
So you're talking about if there's an out-of-town visitor, right, who's got private insurance.
Correct.
it would cover it.
Right.
If it would more than cover it.
It would take two ish.
Yeah,
over
two.
Yes.
Yeah.
Two for Medicare.
Yeah, it was two point something, 2.5 if it was Medicare only.
Yeah.
But most of the tourists coming here typically are younger folks that are not Medicare.
Can I add one more thing to the, I just want to add one more thing to the mix with the Monterey County stuff. I've talked to Lori about this. With Highway 1 being closed and them not coming down from Monterey, we've inherited 14 campgrounds from the slide south that are going to be open by the midsummer. Before the road is fixed, the campgrounds are already going to be open. And we've already ran calls up into them once this week already, or this month already, for a 22-year-old that had a medical emergency. And it takes about 5.5 hours by the time that ambulance was, from the time the ambulance left Cambria till I got back to Cambria. And we usually go up there at night when they get dumb and drunk and stuff like that.
And one call is worth 6 hours. If it's over 6 hours, then we get to bill an extra $250 per hour.
Correct.
Yeah.
I think when Tim and I were talking, I mean, there's the potential with the hotels and the campgrounds and other venues up in Monterey County that we could be increasing the population by, 2,000 people every weekend that we're providing coverage to. So I'm in support of this proposal, and just because I think it makes sense, and I think it is helpful for Tim to be able to schedule people to work a holiday weekend in advance. He got really lucky during the storm because it was on a week during the week, and we didn't, and it was easier to find people to come in and cover those shifts. But I think for a holiday weekend, you need to plan in advance to do the scheduling as well.
Okay, my
understanding is that the proposal this isn't just for weekends, right?
No, this is specifically, this one is for Memorial Day, and then we'll have to reevaluate, I think.
Right.
A question.
When you go to July 4th, of course, you're in the next fiscal year.
Right.
A question.
I'm reading something different here.
The proposal is for peace.
It's all summer, from May 28th through September 6th.
Just for holiday weekends. There's three weekends during
Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day. Those three weekends specifically.
Okay, I just point out that the recommendation doesn't say that.
It says during peak periods from Memorial Day weekend to Labor Day weekend, correct. And by peak periods, if you did make a motion, you could specify those three holiday weekends. Because that was the intent, was those three holiday weekends, not every week.
I feel a lot better.
Sorry about that. I meant to say the three holiday weekends during that time period.
Got it.
Now, if things go crazy, I'll come back to the board later and say, wow, maybe we need to do this every weekend all summer long, but we'll deal with that. We'll cross that bridge if it happens. That would be strange, but who knows? But at this point, it's just those three holiday weekends.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I had to switch to the phone because I was fading in and out on Zoom.
Yeah, this is a lot better.
Okay, are we basically looking at approving an expenditure of $1,980?
In this fiscal year, yeah.
Yes.
But you're doing it for two other weekends.
For each of three weekends.
Okay. I'm not sure why this is coming to the board. I think the approval for $1,980 is well within the administrator's approval level.
I think the concept needs to be sanctioned by the board. I mean, I'm more comfortable with the board saying, yes, we agree with this concept. Than simply the administrator and the ops manager deciding on their own that they're going to up staff.
Yeah.
Anyway, anybody else have any views?
Let's do it.
Okay, I will entertain a motion then to approve the recommendation with the caveat that it is for Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day weekends at this point.
I would move to approve upstaffing for those three weekends.
I second that.
Okay, Lori seconds. Simone, would you do a roll call, please?
You better off?
Yes.
Bill Wright?
Yes.
Laura Millior?
Yes.
Cecilia Montalvo?
Yes.
Cecilia Lamelli?
Yes. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now moving on to the last item, agenda item E6. Is there any public comment? Okay, hearing none, we will then turn this over to Cecilia to bring us up to date on the primary care RFP responses.
Yeah, so what I'd like to do here, this is not an action item, obviously. I'd like to be respectful of the committee that's been established. So let me tell you who we have on the committee. We have Bill, although I think he can't make our first meeting, and myself, Christy. And then we have Barbara Bronson Gray, and we have Dr. Gong, and we have Andy Packard.
Picard.
Yeah. And so I think that's a nice mix. I mean, we'd welcome any other suggestions if you have. We're going to have a meeting on Thursday. And at the Thursday meeting, we will review all the proposals we have at this time. And we will also review the consultant's analysis, which is complete. And that includes what the cost of doing it ourselves would be. And a qualitative review of, it's more of an opinion that the consultant is rendering about the pluses and minuses of going that route. And at that time, you know, we're really gonna be asking the committee to, so that, by the way, will end the work of the consultant, which I have to talk about in just a minute, but we really have to ask the committee where they wanna go from here. And that's a board decision, but I just want to get their opinions and ideas about steps moving forward. So we should have a lot to report on at the next meeting. I would ask that this be on the agenda for the next meeting. And I think I'm going to need to, I was informed today that we have $300 left for the consultant, and I did ask him to present his work on Thursday, and I don't think that $300 is going to cover the meeting. So, I mean, I don't know if I need approval for that either, Bill, but we're going to go a little over just to have him attend the meeting.
I think you've been given a budget, and so I think in order to pay the consultant more, you're going to have to ask for an increase.
May I ask the board to consider an additional $1,000? I don't know that we'll spend that, but I just don't want to go above without the board's approval.
Does anybody have any objection to the extra $1,000? Okay, hearing none, then the board approves.
That was it.
Can I ask Cecilia a question?
Sure.
You had a public comment period at the beginning, and
well, I'm asking,
I prefer to stick to that approach.
She made a comment during her presentation that she had received proposals. I just want to know if she's able to let us know how many proposals, requests for proposals that you have received.
You know, I really would like to discuss this at a future meeting.
Okay, yeah. No problem. Thank you.
Okay, so instead of no immediate fiscal impact, it's maybe $1,000 more at this point, and you've reported on where we stand with the RFP. So your meeting is going to be on Thursday, the 18th of March.
Yes.
Do you feel you need a special board meeting sooner than April 20th to give the board a review of the committee's work, or is the 20th soon enough?
That's a good point, Iggy. We may need a special meeting.
Okay. Well, you can when you meet, you can consider that. And if you feel that you need to make it the subject of a special standalone meeting, then you can simply ask Mike to set one up. And I think for a special meeting, you'd only need to give us in the public 24 hours notice. But obviously, if we could have more notice, that would be good.
Yeah, I will absolutely do that.
Happy
That brings to a close the regular business, and we have several items that were mentioned for future agenda. Mike, do you want to review those, please, or Simone?
I've got the part-time costs or increase in part-time wages, sorry. And the Tim and I will get the data as far as the full-time cost impacts, so you can look at that. And then the one we just talked about, the primary care proposal, will be on the agenda with a report from the ad hoc committee. Those are the two items that I had noted.
May I ask this thing about the California Voting Rights Act be agendized for closed session so we can understand better what's going on?
Yeah, we could we could do that. Yeah, because
I need to sign it, and Lori needs to come in and affix her signature to the resolution that we passed. But yes, so we'll set up a closed session on that.
Okay.
So that's 17-21, as I recall. And also, how about QI? QI plan.
QI plan.
Okay.
Okay.
And audit? I mean, tentatively anyway. I presume that prior to the 20th of April meeting, there'll be a finance committee meeting. But tentatively, I'd like to say that we're going to review the draft audit report in April. Is that fair to say, Bill?
No, I think the draft audit report goes to the finance committee. They approve it, and then we go final, and the final audit report is presented to the board.
Okay, so that may not be until May?
Correct.
Okay. All right, so part-time wage proposal, primary care, QI plan, closed session for resolution 17-21.
Got it.
Anything that I forgot?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, well, we're adjourning at 7:46 p.m. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Yay.
Yeah. Oh, my. I didn't realize you were saying
that. Is that today?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
You have green on your patch, so you're safe. I don't have to wear green tomorrow, so I don't get
pinched. I used to have red hair. I probably started working here.
I don't want to get pinched, yeah.
Mine's blue green. So
I used to hate that in like grade school, man. If you didn't green, they would pinch you.
I didn't own anything green.
Are you going to be able to pull it?